Welcome to the Confident Couples Podcast. Today, we have a showdown between two Enneagram 8s with some different ideas about budgeting.
The showdown of the Ochos.
So on today's episode, we had another amazing interview with an expert guest, and her name is Lindsay.
From Mind, Money, and Balance, and we get into why budgeting is not all about the numbers.
Ooh, is Bud giving you a sneak peek into the outcome of this throwdown? Probably.
Potentially, maybe.
But this is such a good episode with one of only a few financial therapists in the entire country. We're so happy to have her on this episode to tell us more about the emotional side of budgeting and why couples might need financial therapy.
Yeah, seriously, there's only 50 of financial therapists in the whole country. So hope you enjoy and let's get to it.
All right, we're live with our very first in-person interview. Today we have financial therapist Lindsay. Lindsay, tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I'm glad to be here in my office here in Ann Arbor. I am one of 50 financial therapists in the U.S., and I primarily work with couples, and we'll talk a little bit more about what exactly that means as we kind of get into things.
Well, I'm really excited to have you on the podcast because I'd never heard about financial therapy until we got connected through a few friends. And we've been following you for a long time on Instagram, where you do an amazing job sharing tips and helpful information for couples, especially around finances. So we want to start by learning a little bit more about what's involved in financial therapy and why couples might need it.
Yeah. So you're not the first person who says, what is a financial therapist? I think a typical response I get is, that sounds really cool. Wait, what do you do? And so what I often tell people is that don't overthink it. It's exactly what it sounds like. I am a therapist for you if you have any sort of emotional, psychological, or behavioral barriers when it comes to your money. The bulk of my clients are couples, and that just sort of happened organically. I'd been seeing individuals, and for those who are married or partnered, it became evident really quickly that I needed both people in the room in order to make an impact and have them make a difference in their relationship. So I work with couples around all sorts of money hangups, and I think what's really important to know is that it's not just about people who are running out of money or who are quote unquote bad with money. A lot of us have money issues even if we have it. And so I do tend to work with clients who maybe even feel guilty that they have money or that they're earning more money than their parents earned or whatever the case may be. So it really runs the gamut and keeps my days pretty interesting for sure.
So if you see couples often who are having money issues, I want people listening to know that money issues are normal. Is that right? Can
Yes.
you tell us a little bit about what are really common types of money issues among couples?
I mean, I think some of the bigger ones are somebody's a saver and somebody's a spender, right? So somebody likes to spend the money and somebody likes to save the money, and that becomes a barrier. But I think, I mean, that's a broad generalization. I think what it comes down to more than anything is how we interpret and understand money and what we identify and align our values with money. And each person's going to be different. So when it comes to a partnership, you're dealing with two sets of values, two sets of beliefs, and two sets of what they feel like is enough to have in the bank or saved or invested or whatever the case may be. So trying to kind of get it all out on the table and add a little bit more to it than simply the dollars and cents behind money.
When you're working with clients, do you find you leading with your financial foot first more often or your therapist foot more often?
Most of the time, my therapist foot. And what will happen is clients will come in with the financial piece. And I do a thorough intake and we talk about some of their black and white stuff that's going on with their money. And then I almost always lay the foundation first with the emotions and then get into the numbers later on. Occasionally it'll be reversed because everybody's just a little bit different, but I often find that going the psychological route and really laying that groundwork and doing that work is the most helpful.
So what's something that might cause a couple to want to work with a financial therapist? Like, In what situation would you recommend, or what problem? How do you know that you've reached the point where you can't figure this out yourself and maybe you should have some help?
Yeah. So I work with a lot of financial planners. They tend to be a pretty big referral source. So for them, it's usually pretty easy because I say to them, the second you start feeling like a therapist and less like a planner, that's a really good time to refer your clients to me, which they all go, oh yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about. I can imagine the couples, but it's for those cases where it simply isn't enough to have a financial plan, or it simply isn't enough to read the books. They need something else. And so if you aren't seeing a financial planner, if you're doing this on your own, which you certainly can do your money stuff on your own, I kind of tell couples, it's time to come see a financial therapist if you feel like you've done all the things and you haven't made a lot of progress, right? So you've read the different budgeting books, you've put things into the spreadsheets, you've set goals, you've worked towards them, and maybe you're even achieving them, but something still feels off, right? So when that money date comes up, or when that money conversation comes up, things feel tense or awkward or uncomfortable. One of the most common and frustrating dynamics I see in couples is that one person tends to take the lead. And there's nothing wrong with the person who's more interested in money taking the lead. But what tends to happen is it kind of splits into this dynamic of the person taking the lead becoming more of the parent in the relationship. And that doesn't feel sexy at all to be in either role.
No, that's so true. And that's definitely something that we've experienced in the past, because Bud's just more interested in investing and running the spreadsheets. Not that I don't care about it, but he actually likes it. And for me, it would be a chore. So I'm just like, great, run with it. I don't care. But when we weren't really transparently talking about our budget every month and reviewing our statements together, it did become a situation where he had more information than I did. And so I would make financial choices and he would be like, why did you do that? And I'm like, why wouldn't I?
Right, right, exactly. And you said a really powerful word right there was information, right? So we know that knowledge is power, information is power. So if one person in the relationship has access to financial information and the other one doesn't, or simply isn't interested, there's that dynamic right there. And you illustrated a really good way to solve that problem, which is just talk about it. It doesn't mean you, Sarah, all of a sudden have to be in the spreadsheets doing all of that, but looking at it once a month and understanding what's going on makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I should be clear to everyone listening. I now at least know what's going on, but there's no expectation that I'm taking over our weekly expense categorization, or I don't even know. What else do you do?
You know the information I tell you.
Wong, wong, wong. Maybe we need some therapy around that.
You guys are in the couch.
We are. Yes, we are on the couch tonight.
So budgeting, we're getting into it. We almost always get into it because it's one of our favorite topics. And truly figuring out our own system around budgeting and how we were going to communicate about it is one of the greatest things we did for our marriage. So we really wanted to talk to you about budgeting today, and Bud in particular had a question.
So we already set up the Instagram throwdown as 2 Enneagram 8. So I have a belief that budgeting's a math equation, and as you add up your income and your expenses, subtract the two, you find what's left or what your shortfall is, and then you go to work on solving that. And for me, it's real logical math.
Yeah.
And it's probably because I have more of a logical mathematical mindset around it and not a lot of an emotional baggage around it. But I know you feel differently, so change my mind.
Ooh, okay. So you're not wrong. It is a very, very simple math equation. I actually really don't like math. I'm not very good at it. And yet I love financial therapy because I firmly believe that most budgeting is really a little bit of math and mostly emotions. And what you're talking about, Bud, is there's usually, I mean, you can approach a problem many, many ways, but there are two big ways that you can approach behavior change. One is the thoughts and feelings side of it, and the other is the action side of it. So let's take going to the gym, like a non-money example first. So one person, you, might say, okay, I'm going to just go to the gym. I'm going to put on my shoes and I'm going to go and I'll be there for 45 minutes to an hour and then I've done my thing. For somebody else who's more of a thinker, who really has to feel it, they have to like really be their own hype person and get themselves really motivated, right? So they have to really remind themselves why it's important to go to the gym. Okay, it's going to be important because it's good for my energy, because I have a family history of diabetes and I know how important it is to manage my blood sugar. I know I get really tired if I don't work out in the morning. They really have to think through all of the thoughts and emotions behind getting up and getting to the gym before they put their shoes on, so to speak. So it's a similar thing with budgeting. You're not wrong, and it doesn't always work that way. And I will have clients, to your question earlier, where I won't look at their numbers. They won't disclose anything to me about their numbers the entire time we work together. For them, it is
really
solely an emotional problem. Totally.
How much of it do you see where it's an emotional problem together, where they, where couples feed off of each other positively or negatively?
Give me an example. Yeah.
So where maybe one person has, you know, the habitual spending and the other person's a habitual saver, and they're clearly not on the same page.
Yeah.
Or so that's like a negative, but then also they're play off of each other in a positive way. Do you feel like it's interconnected, or where you're isolating one person's challenges and then teaching another, your other partner, to help manage or help engage their partner to solve those challenges?
Okay. So the example I often use is in that saver spender example, it comes down to values, right? And so let's say both people in that partnership, they both really value security. That's a value that's really, really important to them. But for
trying to find common ground.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So finding that common ground, but each of them expresses that differently when it comes to their money, right? So for, I'm making this up, I don't know about you guys, Bud and Sarah, but let's say for Bud.
This is the therapy part of the podcast. Yeah.
Put in the disclaimer, this is not therapy. I want to save my licensure. Okay, but so let's say for Bud, security means making a big return on investment. So for Bud, that means buying up real estate and renting out houses and investing really heavily in the stock market. And for Sarah, maybe security means seeing a big number in her bank account. So she wants to save and see it there, and that feels really secure. So that's where the emotional part comes to play, where I can talk with the couples together, each person in that relationship together, and say, you guys both want the same thing. You're just showing it differently in your money. So how can we find that compromise? How can we find a way for both people to feel secure while, like, going back to your logic piece, you might be able to look logically and go, oh my gosh, having so much money sitting in a savings account, you're missing out on so much compound interest and blah, 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 blah. But like pausing for a second and going, well, what is going to make you as a couple feel good? Maybe it's a little bit less in your cash savings account, but maybe it's not hardly anything in there. So working together to try and find common ground. Yeah, for sure.
How much of your work is spent around getting people to think about the future with their savings too? So,
yeah.
You know, we ran across this, and I think this is really interesting that given our age group, we've never grown up in a world where we're working and have pension funds, where this whole retirement planning was really taken care of for us, where the boomers and the traditionalists that are our parents and grandparents' ages, they had, even if they're young boomers, they had usually at some point in time in their career where they were connected with a company that had a pension fund.
Yeah.
Definitely the traditionalists, where we're like completely in control of our financial well-being into our 50s, 60s, 70s to death.
Right.
And I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
Where we're trying to figure it out, and like some of our parents didn't have this planning and financial retirement planning in their 20s and 30s like we did. So I always find it, how do we get people to shift the mindset to looking out to the future and not using scarcity, human natural behavior to, well, I have it now and I just have to spend it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there's a lot of goodness in that question. So one thing, kind of going back to your earlier question about logic versus emotions, is you've just touched on something that's really huge for the millennial and Gen Zers and a lot of the Gen Xers as well, right? We don't have pension plans. So what have we found happen? A lot of people aren't saving for retirement. They're not investing for retirement. Logically, they can look at a compound interest chart and go, wow, if I put away $300 to $500 a month, I would be set. But we're humans. And to your point, we have a really hard time thinking forward. So what research has found is that for companies who offer opt-out versus opt-in retirement plans, they tend to do better. So that means when you get your job, they automatically enroll you into a 401k plan or something similar, and you have to choose to leave that 401k plan. Those are the people who are saving money, not the people who have to purposefully opt in. And that just speaks so much to our human behavior, is the easier we can make something, the better. So, I mean, going back to what do you do if you're not in that situation, I mean, we can use a little bit of science. There are so many apps now where you can, like, age your face.
Oh, wow. I know. I haven't tried any of those lately.
Me either. I've stayed far away from them. But research has shown that if we see our future beautifully wrinkled selves and we imagine our future wrinkled selves as being broke, we are more likely to actually start saving and investing for retirement than if we don't see ourselves in the future.
That's called what you talked about. It's like nudge economics. It's sure. Like the original behavior economics yes. piece of opting in. And then we've got an opt-in at our business and then auto-escalate too.
Yes.
So it forces you to auto-escalate up yeah. to a percentage. So when you opt in, it's the forced opt-in. And then also every single year, it nudges your percentage of retirement savings up 1% up mm-hmm. until I think the max number is 7% of your income. You auto opt in at like 3%. And then over the next 4 years, you have to opt out of the opt up or of yep. the escalation.
Yeah, exactly. It's a like the toad in boiling water thing, right? You don't feel it as much if you're just increasing things by a percent a year versus if you went from not contributing to contributing 7%, that'd be a total shock to your family system.
So talking about budgeting, mm-hmm. I think we all agree couples should budget, or do you yeah. disagree?
Oh, no, I agree.
Okay, couples should budget. So what is your recommendation for how people would get started mm. if they have conflict about money right now? They have conflict about spending. They don't have a budget. Where do they start?
Oh, such a good question. And I'm going to give you such a therapist answer, which I know, which is really that it depends. I know. I have to sit with a lot of uncertainty, so I'm much more comfortable with it. But it really does depend on the couple. I like to think about what's the one thing for that couple that they can change that will be the least harmful for them, right? So for them, if they're eating out all the time, but the idea of cutting back eating out means they have to totally change their lifestyle right now, even if logically that might make the most sense and they might save the most money, it might be like, okay, maybe we should actually just make coffee at home right now. And that's where we have to start.
Like, don't take away all my joy.
Right.
The good thing for us is that we have 4 coffee makers, and I don't know how to use any of them.
I've been making my coffee at home with my choice of the 4 coffee makers. It's very affordable.
We have one for one specific friend, Tessa, that just when she comes to town, she drinks so much coffee. That's where we have the pop machine, the coffee pop machine, just for Tessa.
What are you, the coffee pop machine?
Yeah. The pot, like the regular, yeah. Like,
this is new to me.
Not cannabis pot.
No. I heard the Midwest pop. Yeah. Like pop. I was thinking like a fountain coffee soda.
That's a great thing. Idea. Yeah. Iced coffee through a fountain soda machine.
Yeah. Well, definitely.
We can talk about that over
offline,
dinner. Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, so it depends where to start. Mm-hmm. Find that one thing that mm-hmm. wouldn't hurt so much yeah. to change in your habits.
Yeah, for
what
sure.
What else?
I also think goals are huge. You know, I know you guys just put out a goals episode, but I also think that that can help with the excitement of budgeting, right? So I think for so many of us, we think of budgeting as cutting. And there is some truth in that, but it's also about saving intentionally. So sometimes I like to kind of just ask couples, what trip do you want to take in 5 years? Or what do you really want to do to your house that you can't do right now that you could do if you had an extra $1,000, right? So tapping into some of that fun stuff, and maybe their budgeting isn't cutting back, but maybe it's reallocating things so that they can save more for something that's really important to them. And that can also help get people on board, especially when like the classic saver spender comes in. It kind of is a win-win because the spender is excited that they're going to get to spend money on something, and the saver is excited that there's a savings account earmarked for that upcoming spending.
And the work that we've done on the podcast, we've come to realize that there's two different reactions to the budget. There's people who give me a budget means I have an allowance, yeah, and this frees me, mm-hmm, and give me a budget and I feel restricted.
Totally.
I see the exact opposite. And that is interesting. And how do you work with couples to kind of drill down through that layer of, mm-hmm, we probably go back and forth.
Sure.
There's certain things, if we look through our money behaviors, I think we have, I'd like to spend on certain things, mm-hmm, and then not spend to save, mm-hmm, on others. Sarah would like to spend on certain things and then not save on others. I'm thinking of the decorating budget. I don't want to spend on it.
But I would say in our relationship, I'm the natural saver. So I view the budget as I am allowed to spend this amount, because if I wasn't given a budget and allowed to spend a certain amount, I would try to spend zero.
Yeah.
Which is also really not fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think there was a question buried in there.
How do you peel back the onion with clients around and get to the allowance versus this is like freedom mindset, yeah, and then this is the restrictive, yeah, mindset?
Yeah, so I think language can work really beautifully there. I actually call it a spending plan instead of a budget. But
that's interesting. So yes.
Right, but for our SEO person over here, nobody's Googling spending plan. They're Googling budgets. So I use the B word, but I prefer spending plan. So I work with clients on like, what do you want to call it? You know, you can call it whatever feels good for you. But for me, spending plan feels more freeing because it's exactly that, right? I'm deciding where and how and when I'm going to spend my money. And to both of your points, it's already allocated to be spent in that way. So it feels better. And then just renaming some of those budgeting categories, it does the same thing, right? So instead of like student loans, like that can sound a little depressing. Maybe thinking about like my bachelor's or master's degree education, whatever it may be, instead of like sinking funds, which sounds so depressing. You guys have heard the term sinking funds. It's for those one-off things that happen. So if you pay your car insurance every 6 months, it goes into like this account. So it's not your emergency fund, but it's for things that happen irregularly, but regularly enough that you should be accounting for them, instead of sinking funds like a life happens fund, right? Again, so these, gotcha, small tweaks, yep, to make it a little easier, a little more palatable.
So when you've got somebody, you got a couple, and they're making progress, and they're getting towards kind of maybe, how do I actually do the track and measuring? What do you talk about with clients when it comes to, you've got them on the same page, they're kind of ready to do a spending plan, mm-hmm, a budget. So how do you recommend or advise clients to go through the track and measurement? How do they keep up to date with each, mm-hmm, other? What's shared? What's not shared? What's the interval to share money together and kind of where you're releasing them maybe back, mm-hmm, into the wild almost?
Yeah. I'm going to actually give you an answer. I'm not sponsored by Mint, but I tell all of my couples to sign up for Mint because, again, it's just so easy to have everything automatically categorized for you. And of course, you can go in and tweak it. For those listeners who don't know what it is, it's just an app that tracks your money. So you can link your bank accounts, credit cards, loans to it, and it consolidates it all into one place. For people who are spreadsheet people, you can download it and, you know, export it into an Excel sheet, but it's all there in one place. And I encourage couples to put everything there together. So even if people have a his, hers, and ours account, they can still see everything in one place. In terms of frequency, my couples really only look at their money monthly or quarterly. Starting out, it's much more frequently. It's probably weekly. I actually don't recommend daily because I think for a lot of people it causes anxiety. So I'd say weekly at most. You can get away with quarterly if you're really diligent, but monthly probably as well.
So I wanted to add, we actually helped someone close to us set up a budget on Mint. And I was really amazed by the fact that when you link your accounts, even to start with, it brings in some of your historic transactions and shows you how you've been spending money in the past. So I thought that was super informative,
yes,
that these transactions came in that based on where the money was spent, they were categorized, food, fun stuff. I don't remember, mm-hmm, the actual categories. Mm-hmm. And then it had an immediate pie chart. Like, yeah, this is how you've been spending your money. It was fascinating.
Right. And I think that's what's really important about Mint. And you can use Capital or Quicken. There's a bunch of different options too. But one thing that you're talking about as well is this absence of mental accounting that happens when you use an app or when you're actually looking at your bank account. Because what I also found was that I would have clients come in and I'd say, okay, give me your numbers, right? And they would hand over their numbers and then we would talk about it. And I'm like, again, I don't really love math, but I'm going, something isn't adding up. You're telling me you only spend $100 on groceries. Let's talk about that. You're a family of four. There's like, it's just not happening, right? So I think being able to see that spending also helps to illuminate where that money is actually going. Because I think we all idealize, oh, I only get coffee out once a week, right? I only go out to dinner once a month. I only buy shoes every few months, whatever it may be. And then when we actually see those numbers, it's a little like, oh, okay, maybe I'm not as diligent as I had thought I'd been.
You're right. When we got married, we combined our bank accounts and started budgeting right away. So for me, it's fun to look back now as we've turned a decade to the 2020s and to see some of the old behaviors. And I still remember the first few years of our marriage budgeting together, like we missed all kinds of stuff all the time.
Yeah, all the
time. And we've gotten much, much better at it as we've gone along, for sure. I mean, I think in 2019, we missed like two or three budgets instead of like, you look back to 2009. When did we get married in 2009? When did we get?
2011.
There we go. Boom. Not great with dates. That we missed all kinds of stuff that year, probably like half. Like we said we were going to spend $1,000 on category, like entertainment. We were like,
sure.
We blew through that in like the first 3 months.
Oh, I know.
As an example.
Right. Exactly.
So another thing that I am really passionate about is that spending will rise to the level of income. I think the economic term is the marginal propensity to consume, where you get more money, so you're just going to consume more.
Yeah.
How do you work with clients around that? As you know, we're a podcast focused on young couples.
Right.
The goal is that for us to grow our income. And with income comes things like lifestyle creep, and I want this new shiny toy or that new shiny thing. So how do you work with clients to try to spread that gap out so more and more of their income is saved?
Yes.
And they try to kind of hold the line on their, at least what we try to do is hold the line on our lifestyle so we can contribute more and more dollars towards savings.
Yeah. So yeah, you touched on lifestyle creep or lifestyle inflation, which is this idea that the more money we earn, the more money we spend versus the more money we earn, the more money we save. And that makes perfect sense because we tend to do what the people around us are doing. So if we get a big raise or we are doing amazing in our business, we're then probably surrounded by other people who are doing similar things. And unfortunately, most people, we're not trained about financial literacy. We're not trained about saving and investing. We don't learn it unless we seek it out. So a lot of us do exactly that, right? So my husband and I moved into a new neighborhood about 2 years ago. Oh my gosh, almost 3 years ago now. And we had that lifestyle inflation happen, right? So we were in a neighborhood where we started doing small things, right? The neighborhood barbecue, instead of like making potato salad, I'd go to like the bougie corner market and get like an artisan potato salad.
Sounds delicious.
Right.
I want to come to this party.
Yeah. It was fantastic, right? But instead of spending like $5 to make a dish to pass, you end up spending $30, right? And it's all those little things. Actually, the tipping point for us was we're in Ann Arbor in Zingerman's Deli is a big deal here. Yeah.
Huge deal.
But it's also really expensive, except they have a drive-through option by our neighborhood where sandwiches are like $6 or $7 instead of 14 or 15. So then we started.
Where is this place? Yeah,
I'll give you guys directions on the way out. So we started like justifying it like, oh, cool, we're getting like half off. Let's just go, right? Well, you're not getting half off when you're still spending money every time you go to eat. So those were just some like lifestyle inflation creep things that happened to us. So to your point, how do you play with your new money without blowing through it all? And I like to tell people kind of what you were hinting at, Bud, which is just pretend you have your old salary and then funnel that additional money into other things. So I think about when I talk to my couples about this, I'll say things like, what would you do if $5,000 landed in your lap today, right? And immediately their eyes light up. They're like, oh, we would go on vacation. Oh, we would do this addition. We'd get a hot tub. Like, they have so many ideas. And then we talk about, okay, well, what would you do if you got a $5,000 raise? And then they're like, oh, I don't know, once you take out taxes, blah, blah, blah. Like, they start to kind of reel it in. So what I like to do is teach them that that thing could be available to them if they treat their old, their new salary like their old salary. So say they were making $70,000 and now they're making $90,000. I say, let's still pretend you're making $70,000. Then you get to funnel that extra money into a hot tub and into your retirement or into your investment. And I don't think there's anything wrong with splurging and having some fun so long as you're not blowing through everything, because that's going to cause a ton of anxiety.
Do you see couples setting up agreements or like we have an agreement around a percentage of income that we're going to save or a percentage of a bonus that we may get that we'll save, where there's like an agreement and a predefined plan.
Ooh, that's no, one thing but I'm going to start doing that.
I think you should give an example. I don't know the exact percentages off the top of my head, but we said a long time ago, let's be careful if we do get a bonus somehow to not go just spend it. So we said, you know, if we get some sort of raise, we're going to save 70% of that new money that's coming in and add 30% to our budget. If we got a bonus, you know, we're going to celebrate 50% of that bonus and save the other 50%.
Yeah.
And it just gave us some rules that we were to follow rather than not knowing what to do if somehow money increased.
Yeah. Oh, I love that idea. I'm going to start telling all my couples to do that.
Awesome. So when you're finishing up with a couples and you know, you're ready to release them into the wild, is there something that you like to leave them with or that them to think about or continue to go back to?
Yeah, definitely. I really like, I love that you guys do your life dates. And I tell all of my clients to do money dates because I think that is one of the highest forms of intimacy, is to dream together and to plan together. And I think with financial therapy or financial planning, you get to do that. You get to do that on a level that a lot of couples just don't, right? So if you're not talking about money, you're actively leaving out a part of your relationship that could be nurtured. So I just always praise my couples who come in for just doing this work. It's really hard. It's really uncomfortable, but it also doesn't have to be. You know, once you start talking about it, like most things, the first couple of times you bring it up, you blush, it's awkward, whatever. But then you get into it and it just becomes normal. You start to have the language and the jargon to talk about it. So I just usually thank all my couples. And then I also just remind them that they're doing something to strengthen their relationship.
That's awesome. That's why we have the financial piece or money piece as part of our three-legged stool.
Yes.
Because you always are coming back to it. And it's, you know, the whole concept behind the three-legged stool, if you want, anybody wants to go back to that episode, it's episode, I think, two or one. Here's where we double zero the first one. So it's episode one where, you know, the three-legged stool, if you keep your communication and your finances and you're intimate with each other, then you can move through life and have a real stable stool to sit on for a long term.
Yeah,
and that's absolutely why we love this work around finance and budgeting as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yes. Oh, my pleasure. This was so fun.
Anything else you'd like to add for the confident couples?
I think this was the nicest Enneagram 8 throwdown that has probably ever happened. I still don't know who won, though. I still would like to know.
Well, my mind has been changed.
Yes, you do.
You do a really good job of talking about the language and talking about people's, you know, feelings. And you are right. The dynamics around how, I'm going to call it baggage for a non-therapist term, around, you know, what we bring to the conversation as a couple was born and bred out of our family and our prior experiences in elementary school, high school, through college, and then, you know, any early work life if you didn't meet your wife or husband or significant other during that time period. Right. So we bring all this weird baggage and to not address it and to just dive right into the logic of it, I think you are missing a point. And that's why couples come to see you.
Yeah.
Because they need help
yeah.
to unlock these challenges to get to the logical part to yeah. track and measure and to really find the results they want and yeah. meet the goals they have.
Yeah.
So my mind has been changed.
Wow.
Yes.
Happy like, to help.
Like anybody didn't think that my mind wasn't going to be changed. Are you kidding me? She's brilliant. She's way smarter than me.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. And for all the confident couples, I have a downloadable template that you can grab that is 5 ways to start the money conversation. Because I think that's one thing that people panic about is they're like, well, to your point, Sarah, with the budgeting is where do I start? So it's literally like 5 different ways that you can say how to bring up money with your partner. So I'll be sure to make sure you guys have that.
That sounds perfect. Is that on your website?
Yes.
Good. And the website address is?
MindMoneyBalance.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much,
Lindsay.
Thank
you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Confident Couples Podcast. If we've helped your relationship in any way, we'd love to hear about it. That's what keeps us going and keeps us recording these episodes. Let us know by submitting an anonymous contact form at budandsarah.com or send an Instagram message to @budandsarah, or best of all, leave a positive review on your podcast app. We hope to hear from you, and we'll talk to you soon.